How can a hawk help someone grieve? Vicki Constantine Croak will tell us about Helen MacDonald's H is for Hawk, a memoir which she reviews this week on our cover.
There's nothing cliched in this book whatsoever. It's very organic, very earthy. She never has to prove this high concept of I find myself through my animal. It's just there on every page.
Should you read the new Nick Hornby novel? John Williams will be here to discuss his review of Funny Girl.
And this is a book, I think, where he's looking back at a time where he either remembers or was living right around when these sort of purely comic and slightly more traditional writers were doing these shows. And it's a bit of a Valentine to them in a way.
Carl Sagal and I will talk about what's afoot in the publishing world. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Vicki Constantine Croak joins us now from Boston. She reviews on the cover this week a new book by Helen MacDonald, H is for Hawk. Hi, Vicki.
Hey, Pamela. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Terrific.
I should add that you know animals and animal books very well. Your own recent book was Elephant Company, the inspiring story of an unlikely hero and the animals who helped him save lives in World War II, as well as a book that I reviewed several years ago for the book review, The Lady and the Panda. And you cover animal issues for WBUR NPR in Boston. So you know animals and animal books, and this is, an animal memoir, but also something more. Tell us a little bit about the book.
This book is, first of all, it's a dream to read. It's just, it's beautifully written, and it does something that a lot of books hope to do but don't quite accomplish. And that is, so Helen MacDonald is a poet and an academic. And she'd been a falconer and always been fascinated by hawks and falcons her whole life. And when her father dies unexpectedly, she finds herself legless. I mean, she just takes it really hard. She doesn't know what she's doing in her life. And her concept of a cure is to get herself a goshawk. And these are one of the most ferocious hawks that falconers ever have. And it's a kind of strange cure. But it works for her. And this book is her journey, getting to know this hawk and getting to know herself by doing it. And in some ways, that sounds cliched. There's nothing cliched in this book whatsoever. It's very organic, very earthy. She never has to prove this high concept of I find myself through my animal. It's just there on every page.
Let's talk a little bit about Helen MacDonald, the author. According to the book jacket, she is a poet, an illustrator, historian, naturalist, and a research scholar in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Cambridge. She's also a falconer. What does that mean to be a falconer?
This is an ancient sport, and interestingly, she talks a lot about the history of it. It was often, particularly in England, the sport of very wealthy men. It's not only classist, it's kind of sexist. So it's interesting that she's been fascinated by that world, and she explores that a little bit. She does all kinds of intertwining of concepts in the book, and one of my favorites was at a moment in which she was talking about the macho-ness of falconry in England. She goes on to describe wiggling into a skirt and putting on mascara when she goes out to a party. Although even in that, she says she's so into her hawk and living this very reclusive life with her hawk that she feels when she gets dressed up and joins the rest of the world that she's in disguise, which is another interesting concept to it. But falconry has been around for centuries, and it's a way to hunt. Hawks have a very interesting tameness to them sometimes, and people have exploited that. Hunters have exploited that to take hawks of various kinds hunting. And in India and the Middle East, it's a very ancient, not just sport, but a way to fill your cupboard with game. So she is well-versed in the history of falconry. She brings her own modern take to it.
You bring a little bit of personal experience to this review as well. In your review, you write, there's a funny mingling of tame and wild in hawks. They can be bred and raised by humans, but they are not domesticated. You've held a hawk or worked with hawks to some extent. What's your personal experience been?
I've been around hawks in many different ways. One was that a friend of mine was a falconer, and I was around his hawks a lot, and I had a fun experience with him. He had two Harris hawks, and they had killed a pigeon. And Perry went and got one of his hawks, and he told me, I had a gloved hand, and he told me to go get the other hawk. The other hawk had the dead pigeon on the ground, and when I approached the hawk, he mantled, that is, he brought his wings over his kill, and he looked up at me and hissed. And so I went to turn to tell Perry, oops, I can't get him. He's telling me not to approach. And as I turned to Perry, Perry said, get him. And I realized I was more afraid of Perry, my friend, than I was the hawk on the ground. So I just shoved my gloved hand under the hawk, and he hopped right aboard and came with me. And this tells you something about this strange reaction of hawks. You can't quite call it tameness, but they are unlikely to attack us, given the right, you have to have a glove, and you're not going to bring the hawk very close to your face. But part of that is I have seen hawks being treated in veterinary clinics, and it always astonishes me that a hawk who has come in from the wild, has had no experience with human beings, will be in a cage, and the rehabilitator or veterinarian can go up to that cage and often just put their gloved hand inside the cage and have the hawk jump aboard and come out. Now, the hawk's pupils are wide, so this isn't a calm bird. But in the situation, the way they deal with it is by kind of shutting down. If you give them the chance, if you had them just flapping around the room, they would attack and try to get out. But it's a very, very different kind of wild reaction to being indoors and being around human beings. And it's one that I've discussed at great length with experts that I know, and I don't know that anyone has a good handle on it, except one of my vet friends says they are predators and they have certain innate reactions to things. And being indoors with a human being, they're not quite sure. It doesn't quite fit their profile of attack.
Now, in this memoir, In H is for Hawk, Helen MacDonald adopts a very particular kind of hawk. Tell us about this bird, whom she names Mabel.
Mabel is a goshawk, and a goshawk is a particular kind of hawk that most falconers don't want to work with. They're known to be ferocious and not have manners, and so a lot of people don't want to work with goshawks. She had always been fascinated by them, partly through the work of T.H. White, Sword in the Stone, and partly because she was interested, again, in this belonging, where do I belong, in identity, and in the British concept of what was a gentleman's hawk. And the goshawk was kind of considered to be ill-mannered, and so she's kind of coming outside of her realm of previous experience. She wants to, her father has died, she wants to rebuild herself, and so she's attracted to one of these beastly goshawks, and she gets herself a female, smallish female, and names her Mabel.
Tell us a little bit. Describe the relationship she develops with Mabel.
It's so intimate. This is one of the most lovely things about the book. She spends time bonding with this bird and getting to know the bird, the first steps of it. So here's a woman who wants to be cut off from the world and withdraw into her own world, and that's just the right stage for the hawk, the new baby hawk that she's brought home. So they live inside of her house, and she pulls the shades, she unplugs the phone, and she's alone 24 hours a day, focused on feeding and training this hawk. And their intimacy, which grows out of that, is just beautiful. And from the beginning, the house is so quiet, and she's so focused on this hawk that she can literally actually hear the bird blink. You know, she smells her breath. She begins to read that hawk body language, whether it's her feathers. When she pulls her feathers and wings in tight, it means she's stressed out. And when she shakes herself and her feathers loosen up and puff up, she's content. What I love about this is that you see MacDonald go from reading the bird and taking inventory of the bird's body language until she gets to the point where what the hawk feels, she feels. It doesn't even go through translation anymore.
H is for Hawk is just coming out here. It's already come out in England, but already it's garnering huge amount of acclaim. It's won the Samuel Johnson Prize. It just won the Costa Prize in the UK. Dwight Garner wrote a very positive review this week in the Daily section of the Times. And your cover review is, I think, what one could call an unqualified rave. What is it that makes this book so good? I mean, there are so many memoirs that come out every year. There are so many animal memoirs that come out of each year. And there are so many memoirs about grieving that have been coming out recently. What distinguishes Helen MacDonald's book?
I think that Dwight Garner called it an instant classic, and I totally agree with that. I think what she's done is pulled off something that people might think of as easy. And Pamela, you know that often people think that writing a children's book is easy.
Right.
And it is.
But wrong.
That's right. And I think in that way, sometimes people think, oh, you write an animal book, everyone loves it. But MacDonald has done something that a lot of people, it's her transformation, her own personal transformation. We like, as readers and as a society, we like the concept that an animal can transform you. An animal in its otherness can bring out your humanity. This book puts together so many elements. Her language is just so beautiful. You see that she's a poet in nearly every line. That said, there's also something of the thriller in this book. It's a page-turner. Every page has a new adventure with her hawk, and she's searingly honest with herself. She really is, she can mock herself. She'll decide one thing she's doing is just right, one concept, and then she'll make fun of herself a few pages later. I think she doesn't let herself get away with anything. But most of all, I think there just isn't a false note in it. And there is something very complicated about this notion. How is it that, it's something that I've thought about so much myself, I do think that animals make us more human. That's an easy thing to say. It's a hard one to prove and to really sort out. And that's most of all, I think, what she pulls off in here. There isn't a, I got a hawk and I was sad and now I'm okay. You really feel her transformation. It's very moving. And I more than once cried during while I was reading this book.
Before we end, I would love for you to read a passage, perhaps one of your favorites, just to whet our listeners' appetites for this book.
That's great. You know what? There truly are so many. It's one of those books where I think I have more underlined than left alone. And the one I would pick is kind of a simple one. And I don't know why. In particular, I think this gives you a flavor of both her poetic writing and also the insight that she brings to her interactions with the bird. So this is early on when she has Mabel in her home, and they really haven't started going out yet into the wider world and into the forest. And MacDonald writes, "I sit on a sofa watching a tired hawk go to sleep. The leading edges of her wings drop and rest against the glove. One downy gray eyelid slides up to cover an eye, then the other. Her shoulders fall. Her head wobbles. The tip of her glossy black beak sinks into the feathers over her crop. Watching her doze in this vesper hour, my eyes close too. But when sleep comes, I am standing in the skeleton of a burned-out house in white blank air that glitters faintly with mica or frost. Around me are blackened joists and rafters. I put out a hand, touch a piece of charred wood, cold, furred, wrong. Rising panic, refusal, a sense of absolute dismay, then of toppling, the house collapsing into itself and on top of me. And we wake together, the hawk and I, her with a start of apprehension, a tightening of feet and feathers, and me with a slow, sickening disorientation that makes me fasten desperately onto the sight of the hawk to drag me back into a world with no ash in it. With same thoughts over and over, why is she sleeping so much? Hawks sleep when they're sick. She must be sick. Why am I sleeping? Am I sick too? What is wrong with her? What is wrong with us? Nothing was wrong with the hawk. She wasn't sick. She was a baby. She fell asleep because that's what babies do."
Beautiful. All right. Thanks, Vicki, so much.
Thank you, Pamela.
The book, again, is H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald, reviewed this week by Vicki Constantine Croak. Vicki is the author most recently of Elephant Company, the inspiring story of an unlikely hero and the animals who helped him save lives in World War II, and also a correspondent for WBUR NPR News, where she covers animal issues. Thanks again, Vicki.
Thank you, Pamela.
Parle Sagel is here now to talk about what's going on in the literary world. Hey, Parle.
Hey, Pamela.
We're going to talk about two poets very different.
That's
Who's
right.
up first?
Who's up first is Philip Levine. Much of the literary world is in mourning for him. He died on Saturday at age 87 of pancreatic cancer. And he was just a very rare and beloved figure in American poetry, which we tend to think of as this very rarefied milieu. And here he was, you know, born and scarred by the Great Depression. He worked any number of what he called just dumb, soul-crushing working-class jobs. He worked in soap factories. He wielded a jackhammer. And even as he went on to become the poet that won almost every major award, he won Pulitzer's, he won the National Book Award, he was the poet laureate from 2011 to 2012, he never lost this commitment to poetry as this vehicle of social change and as this sort of deep social critique.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite poem by Philip Levine?
You know what? I actually want to read
yes.
one little paragraph of his from Dwight Garner's amazing appreciation of Philip Levine that just sort of gets to the heart of it. Because, you know, he did take on all these big things, but, you know, we can't forget, like, the grit and wit and playfulness of his poetry. So just one quick stanza. This is from The Fox. I think I must have lived once before, not as a man or woman, but as a small, quick fox pursued by ladies and gentlemen on horseback. And that's
Lovely.
Philip Levine.
All right, shifting gears to a very different poet, but one that for many people is their entry
exactly,
into poetry.
Exactly. So the big news has been the discovery of a long-lost manuscript by Harper Lee, right? This Ghost Set of Watchmen, which is coming out in July, and it turns out it now has competition because there's another long-lost manuscript on the scene, and that's What Pet Should I Get? By who else? Dr. Seuss.
They've been finding actually quite a number of Dr. Seuss stories
yeah.
In the last few years. There have been a couple of posthumous collections mm-hmm. that have come out. What's the story with this one?
This one was discovered in a box that was found in his house in 2013. And it apparently was written between, they're guessing, 1958 and 1962. And it features the same brother and sister featured in One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish. And the book sort of follows them as they look for the newest addition to the household. So something to look forward to. And hopefully it will be shrouded with less controversy than Harper Lee.
You know, this is one I think that's a lot easier to spontaneously riff in the style of. So we can say,
exactly.
You can get a pet, I bet.
Yeah.
If you do, you won't regret.
Look at you go. Yeah.
So do not fret. Oh, do not fret. Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Parle.
Thank you.
And she loves me. We're as happy as two can be.
John Williams is here to talk about his review of Nick Hornby's new novel, Funny Girl. Hi, John.
Hi, Pamela.
Why are we listening to the theme of I Love Lucy?
Because Nick Hornby's protagonist in this book is a young woman in England in the early 1960s who lives in the north part of the country and aspires to move to London and become an actress, and mostly because she's sort of obsessed with Lucille Ball, and she watches episodes of I Love Lucy with her father, and she basically wants to become a comedic actress, so she goes to London with that goal in mind.
How does that work out?
It works out remarkably well and remarkably quickly. The main character is a woman named Barbara who eventually takes the stage name Sophie Straw.
Barbara, there's a 60s name for you.
Exactly. Yeah, but not a very TV-friendly name.
No.
So, you know, they give her a name more suited for lights. And she very quickly becomes the star of a BBC series at a time when, you know, there were two channels really in the country that people watched and tens of millions of people would watch any given show. And so she becomes the star of a marital sitcom called Barbara and Jim. And the end Jim is in parentheses.
When you describe the sort of atmosphere of this Britpop 1960s world, you make reference to one of my favorite films, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. How does that come through?
Well, that just, especially early in the novel, that was that was the world that was conjured for me by Hornby, because this is sort of the time when the 1950s are morphing into the 1960s. It's not yet a time of full sort of protest and cultural upheaval. It's more a time when a kind of genteel society is learning to take itself a little less seriously and also interrogate some of its institutions, like marriage. And the show is part of that, and the writing staff sort of struggles with how much they can push the limits and how much they can't.
Hornby, of course, is known for weaving lots of music into his books, in particular High Fidelity and About a Boy, about the post-one-hit wonder life of the father of the protagonist. Mm-hmm. Does music figure into this book?
It doesn't really. I mean, it's very much a book about pop culture, but seen through the lens of television rather than music. And I think, you know, there are moments where characters discuss music, but it's very much, I think, a love letter from Hornby to a time that he remembers. He's kind of betraying his age for the first time in this book. He usually writes very much about contemporary
people.
He's
no longer a young British lad.
He's 57 now.
Wow. And so that's a little scary.
It's very scary. But he was always sort of, you know, even when High Fidelity came out, he was in his late 30s. So he was always kind of looking back and trying to recapture, I think,
a younger
time.
It's like Douglas Copeland, like secretly older than you think they are.
Exactly. Sort of obsessed with youth, even when they're not quite in the full flush of it anymore. And this is a book, I think, where he's looking back at a time where he either remembers or was living right around when these sort of purely comic and slightly more traditional writers were doing these shows. And it's a bit of a Valentine to them in a way.
Hornby has gone Hollywood, as they say. He's been a screenwriter most recently. How well does he capture this, the world of TV?
He captures the world of the writer's room, I think, pretty well. You know, the show itself, I think, is wisely kind of left to your imagination, because it's hard to convey really what is funny about something on television by writing about a scene or especially physical comedy. The book really becomes less about Sophie as it progresses and more about these two writers on the show, Bill and Tony, who are really close friends. They're both gay men who are both dealing with that in very different ways. Bill is very subversive and wants to, you know, try to get away with as much as he can. Tony is in a marriage with a woman who, a companionable marriage, so he's a little bit more closeted than Bill is. Bill eventually goes on to write more groundbreaking literature about gay characters.
Mm-hmm.
And their rapport and what they're trying to do with the show and the ways that they try to sort of sneak in their beliefs into the scripts is all very well conveyed. And so I think it's more about kind of the behind-the-scenes creativity of these things, as if, you know, writing about a rock star instead of writing about the concerts you were writing about, you know, the room where you're kind of tinkling on the piano and trying to come up with the tune.
And how convincing is this female protagonist of the novel?
She's convincing. She's a good character, but her arc is her success comes very quickly and at not much cost. And
wanted to see her claw her way to the top.
Well, a little bit. And that, I think that's what gives away early on that Hornby's not so much interested in really her dramatic development as he is in getting her in that position so then he can talk about the wider cultural issues.
All right. I'm sensing, so I'm going to ask you flat out, this is not your favorite of Hornby's novels.
It's not, although, you know, I'm not sure that I think that Hornby's early books are still his best. I think that in Fever Pitch and High Fidelity and About a Boy, which were his first three, he really nailed this voice that was both kind of wistful but also very sharp about pop culture, and it had a lot to say critically, but it also had some sort of wicked laughs. This is a much more traditionally structured book, and I'm not sure that it really suits his... He has a slightly devilish sense of humor, I think, that he doesn't always get credit for, and that doesn't really come out much in this book. I also have the first thought or two toward a theory of what screenwriting does to novelists, and I think Hornby and Richard Russo...
Roll out your theory, John Williams.
Well, it's so rough at this point that I think
you
essentially...
You heard it here first.
You did hear it here first, but I think his early books were just much more voice-driven, and I think he's become more interested in kind of conventionally plotting things. And in a way, it dampens, I think, what was most kind of lively about his early work.
Sort of creating scenes and moving the plot forward.
Yeah, exactly. And this is very much, you could definitely see this being adapted. Although, interestingly, he's never adapted his own work. He writes screenplays for other people, including most recently Wild, which was Cheryl Strayed's memoir turned into a big movie with Reese Witherspoon.
All right. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Pamela.
That was John Williams, who reviews Nick Hornby's new novel, Funny Girl, this week in the Book Review. Greg Coles has bestseller news. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
Well, a whole lot of fiction and not a whole lot of nonfiction this week. We have six new titles on the hardcover fiction side of things. Starting down at number 16, a debut novel called Holy Cow by David Duchovny of Fox Mulder fame.
There had to be a reason for a debut novel there. Okay.
David Duchovny, of course, played Fox Mulder on The X-Files. He also went on to play a novelist on Californication. And so now he's gone ahead and written an actual novel of his own.
About an actual cow.
About an actual cow, yes. The title Holy Cow is sort of a play on words. It's about a cow named Elsie Bovary who sets out for India when she learns that they revere cows there and don't turn them into hamburgers.
Well, obviously he was going to write a book about that. All right.
At number 11, James Rollins and Rebecca Cantrell finish their religious fantasy trilogy, the Order of the Sanguines trilogy. That book is called Blood Infernal. New at number 11. At number 10, Alex Berenson continues his John Wells CIA thriller series with a book called 12 Days. At number 7, Jonathan Kellerman has a new Alex Delaware and Milo Sturgis novel called Motive. Then at number 4, Anne Tyler is back on the list with her 20th novel, again set in Baltimore, again a family, kind of a domestic story. It's about four generations of a family in a Baltimore house. It's really very much a book about the house and what it means to this family.
That's A Spool of Blue Thread.
A Spool of Blue Thread, new at number 4. And finally, on the fiction side of things, J.D. Robb, who of course is really Nora Roberts doing her futuristic paranormal investigating series, the In Death series.
You're very good at specifying the precise genre there, Greg.
It all is in the name. So Nora Roberts as J.D. Robb has a new book called Obsession in Death, new at number 3.
And in nonfiction?
In nonfiction, there are just two new books. One of them, new at number 6, is by a guy named Yuval Noah Harari, H-A-R-A-R-I. That book is called Sapiens, and it's kind of a pop science book looking at how humans, Homo sapiens, became the Earth's dominant species, how it has adapted the Earth to its own ends. And then at number 3, David Axelrod, of course, the Obama advisor and White House consigliere, has a book called Believer, new at number 3.
And that was reviewed last week in Our Pages by David Gergen.
Yes, it was.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.